Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. With me is Phil Conlon. How are you doing, Phil?
Good afternoon, Phil.
Now, listen, we're going to talk today to a couple of very important guests because we have burning issues. We have the matter of the decision in the Trayvon Martin case in the U.S. With about 5:15, we'll be hearing from Glenn Ford, a Black Agenda report. At 5:30, we will be talking to Stephen Gowans who has a great website. It's called What's Left. Very good question, Stephen. And we're going to be talking about the fight in Syria. Syria is on the front line against sectarian terrorists. They are doing quite well, thank you. The Qataris, who are financing them, are determined to see if they, together with their big friends in Washington, can destroy the nation of Syria. They will fail. But at any rate, we're going to talk to Stephen Gowans about that. But let's do two things right off the top. Phil Conlon is an experienced railroad man, a rather romantic trade at one time in America. Phil, we need to talk about what happened at Lac Megantic.
Getting rid of workers, free market, free trade, capital-intensive investment. Mm-hmm. Railways just love every new computer system, every new capital thing, and everything that involves having less and less workers down to the day then they can have none at all. That's what railway moguls love, right? Yeah. And that's what happened at Lac Megantic.
Now, you do have a background. You've worked. You know, what positions have you had? Jobs?
I was what was called non-operating. I worked in freight yards and in mostly in a clerical capacity, but I was a union officer. Mm-hmm. So I always followed the issues of in the other unions, including the unions that represented the people who actually operate the trains. Of whom there used to be a lot more than there are now.
Let's remind people, you know, this happened in Quebec in a beautiful little village which is in the eastern township area. It's a piece of very important part of Canadian and North American history. This is the whole story of our continent as it was unfolding from that region, the French and the English and later the Americans. And Canada, and it's a good chance for us to remind ourselves what has kind of damage has been to an old culture, and how it's going to bring to the surface old issues within the population. But we should remind everybody that train passed through Toronto along what line?
Right across Dupont Street. If it went through Toronto, which I think it did,
they said it came through Toronto.
Well, if they said that, it would have gone across Dupont Street on the Canadian mm-hmm. Pacific main line.
Yeah,
And it would have been proceeding at a fairly good speed. It would have gone into a yard in Agincourt. But at the time that it was going through the core of the city, it would have been going at a fairly decent clip.
A good clip.
Yeah, yeah.
Well. And by the way, that raises an issue. An engineer has written an article. I think people can find it on the net. Can you want to describe that?
Yeah, it's as a former rail engineer, I need to speak out. By James Goodrich. This is in the Gazette of Montreal on July 12th, 2013. James Goodrich is a former rail engineer who worked for three railroad firms, including the parent company of the Montreal Main Atlantic. And he currently works as a self-employed researcher in the energy and transportation fields and lives in Brewster, Massachusetts. So James Goodrich talks about he picked up that it's very useful to have a guy like this writing an article.
Is that findable? Is that
yes, readable? It is. It would be on the Montreal Gazette's website. It was mm-hmm. On July 12, but also I think you could Google his name, James Goodrich. He picked up on something that you need like an experienced railway person to pick up on, which is that the train was under a 5-mile-an-hour speed restriction between Nantes, the yard where it was parked, and Lac Megantic. Well, that's a very, very severe speed restriction, and he said he'd only experienced it twice in his career. I can tell you that when you have a train on a speed restriction of 5 miles an hour, it's because they don't trust the track, and for no other reason.
Well, he says that in his experience, when he was working from photos, he said he was not on the scene, but he's looked at the photographs of the crash. Mm. And he said that he noticed the speed limits were of, was it 5 and 10, right?
Five and 10.
And he said that the only place he's seen that was once in a Boston yard that had been basically become redundant.
Right.
And therefore, if you went there, they extra caution.
Because there was no maintenance being done on the track at all.
He said it indicated to him that there was a known problem with that. He said because actually it's safer to be at a better speed. Right.
Also, yeah, well, I mean, I'll give an example. When I started working for the railway in the early 1970s, every freight train got inspected physically by a human being. Every car on it would be inspected every time a train arrived in a major yard. They would be inspecting for any danger that the brakes were going to burn off or stuff like that. Now, all that is done by sensors, electronic equipment, huge capital investment, and of course, to pay for that capital investment, they got rid of the workers who do those things. What happens when that wonderful capital investment fails? There's no fallback, right? Mm. And it's the same thing with the brakes. But by the way, there are low-tech things you can do, really simple things you can do to prevent something like what happened at Megantic. And the best I saw was a guy who wrote a letter to the Globe and Mail and said when he worked on a track crew in 1964, they used to take a big plank and they would just shove it under the wheel every night before they went to sleep in the bunk car. How hard would it have been to have done that at Nantes? So if everything else were to fail, if there were no brakes on, it's not going to get started.
It would have been the old way.
Yeah.
When you used to have more guys
who needed people to do that, right?
You know, management plays a game of we don't need them.
Yeah.
Well, of course, where is the guy who used to put the plank under the wheel?
Yeah.
Oh, well, you're going to pay a guy to do that.
That's primitive technology, but the thing is, railways have...
We're seeing the inferiority of what I would call bourgeois reasoning or capitalist reasoning. You say, oh, well, he just turned that switch once. Yeah, and saved everybody.
Right.
It's like the time that the man, the genius behind General Electric, who did all their technical work, one time they had a problem, a major site. They called him. Because he was retired. He came, he looked around, and he did something, and he said, it'll work now. And they said, and then he sent him a bill, like $25,000 or $200,000. They said, well, why should we pay that much? He said, because I'm the one who knew where the problem went.
Well, that's
because you never would have fixed it.
Yeah.
I mean, they have this thing, you know, it's like anybody's ever done any manual labor knows there's a bunch of things, oh, well, stand around and dust something. You know, the idea that you have to keep this guy moving, otherwise he's not worth his money. Well, of course he's worth his money. If you've hired him for certain tasks and he does them, that makes him worth it.
Well, and by the way, you always saw that on the railway. And
you don't want him out chopping weeds because it bothers you sitting in your air-conditioned office watching him.
Yes,
he has to go and do something.
No, for sure. And if a worker is busy 6.5 hours out of an 8-hour shift keeping things safe, you've got some boss worried about the fact, but we're paying him for 8 hours. Right?
That's right.
And he's not working 8 hours.
And the answer is,
are you safe? Yeah, get rid of the guy. And we have some wonderful machine here, some sensor, some computer. It solves all the problem, right?
Yes,
and I have to say, this mentality has been going on for an awfully long time, and it leads to a result like what we had at Megantic, I think.
Yeah. Okay, they said that they had a one-man train.
Yeah.
They had 73 cars.
Yeah, 73 cars.
Loaded.
Yeah.
73 cars, and they called it a one-man train, but you say that is incorrect usage.
In the usage that I learned when I was with the railway, I would call this a zero-man train because what we always understood is when you talked about a five-man crew or a four-man crew, you weren't including the engineer in that count. You know. And to me,
why is that?
Because the engineer's job is to drive the train,
right,
and to follow the orders of the conductor, who is the boss. This guy now doesn't have a boss.
People have
to
us, Phil, you're bringing a revelation. Yeah. We would all assume that the engineer is the boss.
As an example, would you fly a 747 across the ocean with one pilot? You could.
Yeah.
You could.
Well, suppose they told you it was his training flight.
Yeah.
And all right, everybody, we got 400 people here. But we want you all pull for this kid because he's never landed one of these.
Well, of course.
Don't make him nervous.
You know, the thing is, to this day, the Canadian railway operating rules are a big, thick book of rules. And these are rules. You can be fired for not following them. And one of the rules in there is called, there's something called failure to protest. That is to say, if there's two guys or three guys or whatever working on a train crew and the engineer is violating the rules by speeding, goes through a yellow light or something like that, then... If the other crew members don't pull the emergency brake or rat him out, actually, no, because that's what they have to do, they are equally guilty, and they will all lose their jobs over it, right? And yet, that's how important it is to have the workers watching each other in that rule book, right?
Well, this guy would have had to been watching himself.
Watching himself, of course. I mean,
maybe he should put a mirror on his shoulder.
How ridiculous is that? You know. By the way, one of the nice things that the author of Mr. Goodrich of this article points out, it does a little of arithmetic as how many truck drivers it would take to drive that quantity of oil. And it was well over 200 trucks with 200 drivers.
You would just see perpetual trucks running.
Yeah. So why couldn't the Montreal, Maine, and Atlantic have had a second guy in that crew? I mean, the guy can't make money. The poor capitalist is going to go broke because he didn't.
Well, and of course, it leads us to this other, which we know that there's going to be plenty of talk. But one game is to wait till everything blows over and bring in company experts and whitewash it. But clearly, the concept of oversight should be there. Are we a country or not? Do we have leaders or not? These businesses are permitted. They don't own the damn country, or at least they ought not to, and they have to obey what the population wants. If they don't like that, then take their railroad and go somewhere else.
Right. And by the way, Phil, I think we should mention what almost happened in Calgary. At the height of the flood, the greatest disaster in that city's history, the CPR got the brilliant idea to run a fully loaded train over a damaged bridge in floodwaters, right? Mm-hmm. And it almost led to all of those cars of oil ending up in the river. And the mayor of Calgary, who's a very well-spoken guy, said, I have an emergency in the city. I can order everybody to do anything I want, but I can't tell the railroad what to do because the way the law works in Canada, I've got nothing to say. He can run his trains through my city and ignore
it. He at least did that. He did that. He said it. Instead of pretending that he had power that he didn't have, he told the people where the power was because they have a right to know. Who am I? It's the old thing, I'm going to complain. Who am I going to call? Who are you going to call? I guess Ghostbusters. There's a detail published in the Montreal Gazette, and I'm not going to let this go by because the story was confirmed, that a company investigator was wandering around unannounced, and a Gazette photographer. The Montreal Gazette is an English language newspaper, not very friendly to the Francophone media or to the Francophone political leadership. It struggles with them all the time. However, their photographer reported that he was taking pictures. The investigator walked over and said, "Get out of here." And he said, "I have a right to be here. I'm a journalist," and all that. And when he and the investigator became hostile towards the Gazette photographers, following that, locals who were concerned, watching, want to know who's here, came and asked what's going on, but they spoke with French accents or in French, to which the investigator said, "You're frogs."
Yep.
Our witness is the Montreal Gazette newspaper. And I haven't seen the Globe and Mail and the Toronto Star repeat
that. They have not reported it. They haven't reported it.
That's because, we protect our own, right?
Yeah.
That is a nasty deal. I'd like to know who the guy was. I don't know that he's been properly identified, but if you use that kind of language, they should have the power or be questioned. Why is he continuing in employment? Because there's no dispute, I understand, about what happened. But everybody thinks that's okay. I mean, here you have people in pain who are, anxious about what's going on under their feet now, particularly on the company side, and someone uses racist language in speaking to them. And with that makes an appropriate segue, because I believe we are joined by Glenn Ford of the Black Agenda Report. Are you there, sir?
Yes, I am.
Glenn, thank you very, very much. This is an important moment in American history. You had many, but on the question of racial issues and violence against black people from the state and from vigilantes, this seems to be the Zimmerman matter. Seems to be one of them. I want to know how are you characterizing this, and if you could sort of summarize how you think we ought to be viewing this.
Well, in light of the Snowden revelations and WikiLeaks and such, it's well known that the United States is a surveillance state as well as a mass incarceration state. But black folks have been under surveillance Well, since slavery time, there is nothing unreasonable in white people's minds for keeping black folks under constant hyper surveillance. Mass black incarceration is the law of the land because there is a surveillance state, a constant surveillance of black people. It is the intake valve for mass black incarceration. And this is accepted and endorsed by most white people in the United States. Now, this is important from a legal standpoint because we have deeply embedded in American law the doctrine of reasonableness. What does a reasonable person do? The difference between murder and manslaughter and self-defense is all based on whether a person was acting reasonably. Did they have a reasonable fear for their life or that someone was going to do bodily harm to them? And so once a white person who assaults or kills a black person can convince a jury after already convince a jury that they were acting reasonably, then the case against them disappears. The George Zimmerman's surveillance of, his profiling of, his hunting down of, and inevitable confrontation with Trayvon Martin was reasonable conduct as far as the police were concerned in Sanford, Florida. That's why the police did not originally bring a case against him.
Incidentally,
if it is reasonable to profile young black men, then anything that is a product of that profiling is the profilee's fault. The onus is no longer on the profiler, and he is judged to be a reasonable person acting in a reasonable way, and that's what the verdict said.
Glenn, in a way, isn't this really typical justice as found in Florida? Isn't this what happened?
Typical, in fact, the way it's found everywhere in the country. I'm speaking from 30 miles outside Manhattan, which is the capital of stop and frisk. Stop and frisk is institutionalized surveillance and confrontation with black males as a class of people. Once you have a class of people for whom it is okay to surveil, profile, and confront them, then anything that grows out of that reasonable conduct by law enforcement can be imitated by civilians without any moral condemnation. Zimmerman was simply doing what police do. And in fact, in the trial, you saw it was really a very unique kind of situation in which the prosecution witnesses, the cops, were really acting as defense witnesses when they were asked if it seemed to them that Zimmerman had any malice towards Trayvon Martin. The cops said no. And of course they said no. Zimmerman was doing what they do, targeting young black men and ultimately confronting the young black man. They do that every day. They claim it's not with malice. They would argue, well, how could it be with malice? Zimmerman did not know Trayvon Martin, so how could he bear malice against him? Well, Zimmerman had malice towards the whole class of people that Trayvon Martin belonged to, just like the police do.
And they had a tape recording to prove it.
Yes, of course.
And let me ask you, how did... It's my understanding is that neither the prosecution nor the defense thought treated this as a racial incident, that their philosophy was separate.
Surveillance and profiling of young black men is American as apple pie. It is what reasonable people do, whether in uniform or out. Mm-hmm. It has been that way since the days of slavery, when not just the slave owners, who were a minority of the white population, but the white population in general was obligated to keep its eye on the slaves.
Yeah, neighborhood watch, right?
It was the white neighborhood watch, and it's been so forever. One of the reasons that the Confederates did so well in the Civil War against overwhelming numbers and resources of the North is because almost all Southern white males had served in militias, and the militias were nothing but security, neighborhood watches deployed against slave rebellions.
Yes. I remember that the famous Dr. Mudd was the organizer of the slave-catching militia in his neighborhood.
That's right, and they were reasonable people, one and all, weren't they?
Yeah. Yeah, they went all the way and did the deed. I mean, now, what about, a horrible expression, jury of your peers. How is it that six white women ended up the peers?
You know, we have long and intense conversations about this 50 years ago. It is the kind of discussion from which the Black Power movement grew. It raises very basic questions about the ability of the races to coexist in this society as the law is configured. Because embedded in the law is this subjectivity. Racism is nothing if it is not the most extreme form of subjectivity. And that subjectivity says that white people are reasonable in fleeing neighborhoods that blacks might be moving into. They're reasonable in fleeing schools that black folks might attend. It's reasonable for them to withdraw their financial support, their taxes, from cities
reasonable.
That turn to black, and it's reasonable for them to create police states in black America. And the consequences of all these reasonable actions, reasonable from a white supremacist mind, are a million black people in jail and the virtual destruction of black family life, as Trayvon Martin's family.
Mm-hmm. Black Agenda Report, and it's blackagendareport.com, and I urge people must go to that site in the light of this incident in particular, stressed recently that now we have the issue of affirmative action has been sidelined. The one thing that Martin Luther King and Malcolm X both agreed upon was if you're going to solve the problem in America, you're going to have affirmative action, and it used to be regarded as a decent expression, something to be sought after. But your Black Agenda Report points out now a new word has come in and bumped it aside called diversity.
Yeah, and actually affirmative action in the United States was fully dead with the Grutter decision in 2003. So it has been dead and buried for at least 10 years. Its substitution by diversity began not long after affirmative action became national policy. Understand that affirmative action was seen not just by its movement activists like Dr. Martin Luther King, but by Lyndon Johnson himself when
yes.
he spoke to Howard University's graduating class in 1965. He used language that was virtually identical to that used by Dr. King. Dr. King said that affirmative action should be preferential compensatory programs for black folks as compensation for slavery and Jim Crow and such. Mm-hmm. Lyndon Johnson basically said the same thing. So this was a black program that was rooted morally and legally in the situation of black folks in the United States. However, after King's death especially, a class of political black folks entering corporate life and electoral politics where they could wheel and deal decided that they would share our suffering, share
they feel your pain.
With other groups, and including white women who have benefited so dramatically from affirmative action. Mm-hmm. Well, you can't share the situations, the circumstances, that call for compensatory preferential treatment. That's not shareable. And the only result that could have come about, and it did, was a watering down of affirmative action for black people as originally conceived into a kind of diversity. And a diversity in which the benefits, the whole rationale for the program is not to compensate the descendants of those who have been so abused and held back, but as an option for American institutions to improve themselves, so that black folks don't have standing under to demand affirmative action, yet law schools do, if they can show that they can provide a better education with a more diverse student body. With Grutter, that was basically affirmed that affirmative action was good for American institutions. Black folks were out of the mix entirely. And with this latest decision, it's philosophically the same, except that it says that the burden is on the institutions, the law schools, the corporations, whatever, to prove that before they introduce a diversity program, they must prove that program was the only possible way that they could achieve larger numbers among those diverse groups that they wanted to include in the workforce or student body. But that has nothing to do with compensation of black folks, nothing to do with preferences for black folks.
This is Glenn Ford, blackagendareport.com. And lastly, Glenn, I want to ask you, here we have this political logjam. You have the President of the United States, who seems to serve as a kind of kryptonite against black issues.
I believe that we would have gotten a more honest and open response from George Bush than we got from Barack Obama. We should remember that when Sean Bell was cut down by a fusillade of something like 50 police bullets, Barack Obama also said the courts have spoken and that should be the end of it. He's basically saying the same thing today. Whereas Bush, the elder, not George Bush, but the older George Bush, after the Rodney King riot, was much more open to accepting that this was a racial situation, not a gun control situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What are we going to expect? Maybe a beer at the White House as a teaching moment, or what?
Possible, as long as it's Blue Moon, because that's the cop's beer, you know.
It's a tragic situation. I guess I better ask you lastly. There's going to be the media loves to say, "Oh well, there's going to be a riot or something," but that isn't what's. I mean, there is a crisis of political leadership, right? And do you identify people that people can turn to and say, "Well, look, let's build a program here"?
No, we need a movement, and from the movement, we'll develop new leaders. What we have in Black America is the residue of an old movement, a 40-year-old movement. And that's why it's so geriatric. That movement was taken over, actually put down by this rising new black political class that went into electoral politics and corporate politics. There is no politician who wants a movement. All a politician wants you to do is vote for him every 2 or 4 or 6 years. Mm-hmm. No black mayor wants to have to be burdened with a vibrant and demanding movement in his city any more than a white mayor does. So these people who were catapulted to leadership positions based on the victories of the civil rights and black power movements did everything they could to dismantle that movement so they could get on with the business of enriching and entrenching their own class.
Mm-hmm. Well, Glenn, we're sure glad you're speaking up. BlackAgendaReport.com is essential reading, so thank you very, very much.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you. Bye-bye. That's Glenn Ford, blackagendareport.com. We'll take a break. This is the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM, and you can join us on the other side.